Welcome to Richmond Law and Policy's podcast series. Richmond Law and Policy is a social justice law firm specializing in consumer protection class actions, representation of nonprofits and progressive businesses, and civil rights litigation concerning police misconduct. Our first season gets to the core of systemic issues regarding factory farming and is intended for educational purposes only. Good morning, everyone. My name is Jack Einstein, and I'm a policy fellow with the Richmond Law and Policy Group. I want to welcome you all to today's segment on factory farms with a very special guest, Tom Butler. Tom, do you mind introducing yourself?
Yeah, I am Tom Butler. I'm a hog farmer. I've been in business for 25, going on 26 years. We have a CAFO with 8,000 pigs. We are a little bit different from other farms in the fact that we have done some innovations.
So you have been running this farm for many years now. And at what point did you realize that there was an issue with the way that you were running things?
We started out with six barns and in our neighborhood, and we didn't have any complaints. So about a year later, we built four more barns. And at that time, we started getting complaints. And I think it was the neighbors said, we need to say something because this guy's going to build 100 barns if we don't say something or complain. And there weren't direct complaints to me. It was just through the grapevine that I heard that people were a little bit concerned about our hog farm and it expanding. But other than that, we didn't hear much during the early years. It was just later on that it kind of came to fruition, and when we started realizing that people really were concerned about living next to a hog farm.
And what were the initial concerns? Because I know obviously now people have a lot more information on CAFOs and their harms, but what at that time were people initially concerned about?
It was purely odor, because most people and me as a layman, we don't know anything about pathogens and air quality, water quality, and soil damage and stuff like that from the waste. In the early years, we had no idea what we were getting into. I grew up with about 8 or 10 pigs in the backyard, and that we used that for our meat. And then we went from 10 pigs to 8,000 pigs, and which was quite an impact. And my brother and I were partners when we started out, and we never realized the environmental impact that we would have. And some of the people that do analytical stuff say that we have the waste of a city that's of 30,000 people, because we produce 10,000 gallons of waste per day.
That's quite a lot. And in our pre-interview, you had spoken about there was a university that you're working with to track the nitrates that your farm gives off. Are you willing to speak a little bit about that?
Yeah, we work closely through the years with North Carolina State University. We work with Duke University and UNC at Chapel Hill. We've done most of the work with Mark Rice. He was the interim director after Mike Williams left. And he helped us with trying to solve our nitrate problem. But to date, we have not. We have sequestered greenhouse gases. We've produced electricity from swine waste, which is a good thing. But it's only a first step or two, and we still haven't gotten to the point that we have made an impact other than covering the lagoons and sequestering the odor. That was a big factor.
Right. And what's obviously very cool about your farm versus many other CAFO productions is all the environmental steps that you've taken to try to mitigate some of waste factors of hog farming, and carbon sequestration, and several other initiatives you've taken, such as covering your lagoons to help mitigate some of these risks. Can you tell us about, you know, from A to Z, what kind of what you started with and where you're at now?
Yeah, we when we started out, like I said, we didn't have any complaints in the very beginning. But after about 4 years, we began to have complaints that concerned us. And at that time, my brother and I kind of took an oath and said, we will do whatever we can do to lessen our impact on our community, because we felt that we were not being fair. And one example was 1,500 feet from our farm, my neighbor had just built a $250,000 house. And he called me one night and told me that the inside of his new home smelled like hog blank. And that concerned both of us. And to make it even worse, this guy was my brother's brother-in-law. So that made it even worse. It was family. And from that time, we went to the clean water, best management practices. None of those seemed to improve much. We went from burying pigs on the farm to the dead box. Then we went to incineration, and then we went to composting. And composting has proven to be the best and most friendly way to handle that. We didn't have a big impact until we covered the lagoons in 2008. And we did that selfishly in ways, because we were going to get rich off of carbon credits. That was back during the cap and trade era. But during the Obama administration, the Congress got tied down with the Health Care Act and never got around to our cap and trade. So that just kind of died. And then what we had was, we were capturing all this CO2 and methane under a cover. And at that time, we were flaring it off. We were burning it at 1200 degrees Fahrenheit, which is certified destruction of greenhouse gas. But it was really a waste of resources. We could be using that methane for our fuel. So that's how we got into the generation business and making electricity. We got a very proactive cooperative that wanted to work with us. So we got a pretty good PPA at that time, power purchase agreement. So we put in a generator, a scrubber, and a digester, and started making electricity. But everything was research and development. Most everything did not work. Back in 2010-11 era, there was no equipment manufacturers. There's nobody that were really into this type of situation. So we used material and machines and blowers and stuff that weren't designed for, they were designed for fresh water. They weren't designed for swine waste. So we struggled for 5 years to keep the system running. And we did that. And then we shut down with the full intention of going with a group that had some new technology, but that never came to fruition. So we waited for them for a couple of years, and now we're doing a big upgrade, and we're almost completed that. And what we have now is a much more efficient system with equipment that's designed for what we do. And we're hopeful that when we get it up and running, that it'll actually be a revenue stream and pay for itself. We have a very small system. And in the beginning, we were not very efficient. We could make 50 or 60,000 kilowatts at best, and then that would drop down to, you know, just several thousand, and then back up. And then in the new system, we're expecting to do a minimum of 50,000, and we're shooting for 70,000 kilowatts per month. And that'll be a revenue stream of $10,000 or $12,000 for the farm. And we think that's significant.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And it's really great to hear how you've been able to do all this. Who did you end up working with to be able to sponsor all of this? Or was this the universities that you had worked with?
In the very beginning, I was on a farm credit board, and we had a meeting in California. And I got up with a company out there, Environmental Credit Corp. I talked to the CEO, and they were interested in covering swine lagoons because we had, at that time, had 4,400 of them, and they were wondering if they could sequester methane from lagoons and sell it as carbon credits. So about a month or so later, I got a call from Environmental Credit Corp out of State College, Pennsylvania, and they wanted to cover our lagoons. So they did it under a CIG grant, and we welcomed them to come in. It's a project that we could not have done ourselves, because if you do covered lagoons one at a time, they're very expensive. If you were to do them in segments of 20 farms at the time, it would probably be half the cost. And we were hoping that would happen down the road, but it hasn't so far. And the reason is the industry, for some reason, never adopted that or endorsed it to the extent that they would use it. And then they told me it was fine, go ahead and do it, you know, but they never copied that on any of the precious farms. And I think Smithfield Foods or Smithfield Farms has a few, maybe one or two covered lagoons, but it just never caught on. And then after the cap and trade went south, the Chicago Climate Exchange went bankrupt, then we had all this sequestered methane, and we were just burning it. We weren't getting anything except just flaring it off. And we thought that was a wasted resource. So that's how we got into the electric generating business, through our local cooperative, put in a generator and all the stuff that goes with it, and started making electricity. That's how we got into the first part of it.
So the way I see you, at least all the conversations that we've had so far, is that you're a model farm, especially for people that are contract growers. So the way that you got into this, obviously you were very passionate. You knew that there were issues and you cared. And this isn't to say that other contract growers don't care about their community or environment, but they are oftentimes stuck in these contracts. So there's little that they can do. But one comment that you had made previously was that there are a lot of these grants. Would you say that these other contract growers aren't aware of the grants, or they're just unwilling to apply for them and use them?
There's no education for us as a group to do that. Yeah, it's very difficult. I'm in the middle of a grant right now, and I have the funds allocated, but it's going to be jumping through hoops for the next 6 months to get the money. So I was asked to testify in the House United States Congress on ways to improve these grant applications, because it scares a lay person, a farmer. And if you're big enough to have attorneys and accountants on your staff, it's fairly easy. But it is, you know, quite a job to look at a grant. It sounds good. They solicit people to come in and get these grants. They're just sitting there waiting for, all you got to do is come in and go to work, you know, get the money. And this past one has cost me more than $8,000. I've got another couple thousand, maybe, just in accounting. You have to do GAAP standard accounting if the project's over 200,000, and mine was 500,000. So it can be it can just be something that the average farmer would not want to get involved in. But if the integrator had a person that specialized in grants and helped each grower fill out their grant and get it submitted, then it would be a piece of pie.
So I'm wondering what you think the next step would be. Would it be better education or trying to lobby these organizations to dish out the funds?
Yeah, it would be great if they would better educate the growers, but the trend has been to, and this is not being critical of the industry, it's just the truth, they dumb us down. They want to be in charge. They don't want the grower to be innovative or have any kind of independence. And that's the way it is when you're under a contract. And that's one reason. The other reason is, like I say, they want to be in control. And when you start doing your own thing, like we have at our farm, they aren't completely in control of the farm. And if you ever to make enough money to become semi-independent, then they would have a problem. That's the basis for it. They need to keep you under wraps and taps. And probably, I'm probably 1% that went outside the circle. And all the other guys are great guys. They're good friends of mine, but they will not, you know, go outside that circle. They remain loyal to the integrator. And unless the integrator asks them or tell them to do something, that they're not about to do it. And you've got to think about your contract is always up to be canceled or whatever. But it's the fear of it. It's not a reality because they've got to stay in business and they have to have growers to produce their pigs. So they're not going to fire everybody. It's intimidating. If you owe $400,000, $500,000 or $600,000, you have a $80,000 payment every 20 weeks, you're going to toe the line.
So my next question is, how do you feel about your contract specifically?
No, if I had any way to use my facility and be able to maintain it and keep it afloat, I would do that. And I would, in a very kind manner, ask to be released from my contract. But that's not the case. I'm completely dependent on getting that kind of money. And the thing about it is, even if you have a bad contract, you have a payment coming due. So you stick with it because there's nowhere else you can go to get $80,000 in 20 weeks to make a payment. And you would do it even if you only made 70 and you had to pay 10 out of it. That would be better than having to pay the whole 80,000. So see what I mean? Some people are just breaking even, and that's about where we are. COVID has really touched us. This group, last group, we had a good group of pigs, the best I think we've ever had in 25 years. This group that we just are selling right now is probably going to be the worst that we've ever had. We were having to haul hogs from North Carolina to Iowa to be slaughtered because the Tar Heel plant that's 60 miles away was so far behind, they couldn't take our pigs. And what we had was 380-pound pigs that should have been marketed at 265. They're tearing up our equipment. It's just been a mess. And I'm making a point here. There is payback through stimulus for COVID, but it never reaches the contract grower. It goes back to the integrator, which is called a pork producer. And there's a big distinction between a pork producer and a contract grower.
I hadn't realized that. So
if you're comfortable, how much would you say that you have lost this year because of the pandemic versus previous years?
Well, over the last group of pigs and this, probably 30 or 40,000. And that's significant on a small farm like we have.
I believe you had told me this before, but how long is that trip that you have to ship the pigs now that you can do it locally?
I believe it was 16 or 17 hours. So there would have to be a driver change. Very, very expensive. And the history of the integrators is if there's extra expense, they do all the accounting. And somehow or the other, that expense that they should pay for sometimes drifts down into the contract growers part. And this is, I'm not saying that they're crooked or they're illegal or whatever, but my saying is it's not illegal to be unethical.
So I'm curious, at what point, how large of a farm do you have to be to actually start making good amounts of money and start really
60,000? Yeah, if you had 60,000, we got 8,000. If you had 60,000 pigs, you could put in a system and make a revenue stream that would, you know, be phenomenal. But that's about the limit. So you see what we're dealing with? We're dealing with 8,000 pigs, and we need 60,000 to get in and efficiently make money. And if we could do it as a consortium, if the integrators would work together and put 10 farms together, we'd have 80,000 pigs that we could combine the resources. But so far, the industry has shown very little interest in doing that. And it started way back during the Attorney General, I think it was the Smithville Agreement, back in 2000 or earlier. They had Terra Blue or Super Soils. It was a superior technology that almost made it as being practical to use. And they rejected that system. And 25 years later, we're about where we were then.
So at this point, North Carolina has some of the largest hog industry in the United States. How many hog farmers are there in North Carolina that are not contract growers? Do you know?
Probably less than five, because that was the intention when Wendell Murphy started this system about 30 years ago. That was his first chore, is to put the independents out of business so they wouldn't have that competition. It wasn't arrogant or anything like that. It was just a business decision that they had to control the market if they wanted their system to work. So most of the independents became contract growers because they took over all the feed mills, all the resources that an independent would need. They control the market where the independent had to sell their product. So it was pretty easy in the period of the late 80s and early 90s that the contract system took over. And like I say, there's still four or five, but they toe the line. They're completely dependent on the large integrators. And they know if they make a mistake that, you know, they'll have problems. No threats or anything. It's just reality.
So you've been in a bit of some spotlight here and there in terms of your contract and Prestige. Have you ever gotten any backlash from Prestige itself?
Yes. We have 8,000 pigs. At one time, we were down to 6,000, and that was purely by design. We sat empty one time for 40 days, no pigs on the farm. And the reason was PEDV, a disease that had come through, and they just didn't have the pigs to bring us, stuff like that. It was purely intimidation, but to try to get me back on track. but it didn't work. And I have always taken the chance of losing the farm by being outside the circle. But we're dealing with a good company. Prestige Farms is as fine a group of people as you'll ever get up with. But we just want to, and I'm an advocate for change, not an activist against the industry. And if we could just get them to see what we see, it would be great. But I've sat down with the one of the Prestige sons that runs part of the industry, and they just aren't interested. And the reasoning is everything that we do is based on subsidies, and they don't like that. They say when the subsidies give out, it'll go. But I bring up solar in North Carolina. We're number two in solar in the United States. And 10, 12 years ago, they said that North Carolina could never become a solar state. So it can if you'll get involved. And back then, the legislature was kind enough to have 30% federal tax credit and 30%, 25 or 30% state credit. And that's how it got it off the ground. And then later on, 5 years later, they told them they didn't want their money, their tax credits, that they were independent. And so that's the reason we're number two and very successful in solar. And it can happen to the swine business and electricity, or the newest thing, of course, is compressed natural gas and injecting it directly into the pipeline. And that way you got access to the California market, and you can get about three or four times the money for natural gas in California as you can here. They call it a virtual pipeline. It doesn't actually go to California, but it's all done virtually. So that's the next step. But a lot of things could happen if the industry would just endorse it and adopt it. And the biggest issue we have now, of course, is the spray field system. That is our thing that's hanging over our head that causes the most problem. And I would like to see the spray field system, done away with and new technology to come in. I was asked by a company representative, says, Tom, you're always talking about these new technologies, and says, tell me one that'll work. And I told him, any of them will work if the industry adopts them. They can make it work. They have the resources to make it work. You can take a bad system in the beginning and make a good system out of it if you're willing to adopt it. But you can't do it one system at a time.
There was some new technology that you had told me about the last time. Is that related to what you're speaking about now?
Yes, that is our last step. We're at solid separation now. We got to get rid of the solids. Instead of storing them in a lagoon, we have to not do that. We have to stop storing waste. And there is a system you can separate the solids that becomes mulch and other products that are marketable if somebody will do the homework, do the background work, create the market. There's a need for it. There's just no ready market for it. And then the last step is actually the what we call osmosis and reverse osmosis. If you want to go that far, you can actually feed the pig waste back to the pigs as water at the end of that system. You can actually drink the water. And I've been to two systems and done that. Both of them were dairies, but same thing. And to make it really bad, to show them what they haven't done, I did that in 2000 here in North Carolina. I went to a farm, and they had a little system there, and the big waste came out of the farm, out of the barn, into this system, and 2 or 3 hours later, you could drink the water. And the water was going directly back to the pigs as drinking water. And they never bought into it. The guy had a little patent system, and they just rejected it entirely.
Was this a small farm that had done this, or was this another contract?
Yeah, it was a contract grower down in eastern North Carolina.
That's great. You say that you had done this yourself too, or you just observed it?
I've just observed that. This is what I want to do. That's our last step, is to turn our hog waste back into drinking water. And the whole industry can do that. We can be safe. We're going to still have odor issues. We're going to still have whatever comes out of the barn that you can't control. We also have wind wall projects that lessen the amount of pathogens and dust particles and odor that come out of the barns, and that's being developed. But if the industry said, look, we're going to put that on 100 farms, you know what happens? It works, and people start making better and better equipment, and you can control that. But it all comes down to the board of directors saying, how much is this going to cost? And as the CEO of Smithfield Foods said, you know, if there's not a profit in it, we're really not interested. And in the beginning, there's not going to be. It's going to cost a nickel or two in the beginning, and then you'll recover. But what I've said about any industry that is successful on the back of people and the environment, they shouldn't be proud.
So obviously most industries like to keep costs down. What sort of help, or who would you need help from, to be able to get these industries to adopt some more of these policies? Who would you need help from? What would you need to do?
Well, the USDA does their part and nationally, like the state of North Carolina offers absolutely no incentives to the swine industry to do anything. Our former governor, Jim Hunt, more than 20 years ago, says, look, I mean, he saw it then. He said, we got these guys in a bind. We put that lagoon out there. In 10 to 15 years, it's going to be full, and we've got an issue, and we need to help these guys now. And his suggestion was split the cost. USDA will normally pay 25% without any issues. The grower will pay 25% and can afford that. Integrator pay 25%, and the state pay 25%. You got your full dollar, and you've got a problem solved. But they never caught on. It just never caught on. And there's no reason for the industry to do that. They're all about efficiency and profit, and that's what they're designed to do, is make corporate is designed to make profit, not to be good guys. And that's what it's come down to. You can be a good environmentalist, you can be a river keeper, or you can do this, but you can't make any money. That's the way they look at it. It's not true, but that's the way they look at it.
It's understandable, at least from a capitalistic perspective. So you had also been a neutral party in a lawsuit. Can you speak a bit about that?
Yeah, due to the fact that we've done all this innovative stuff over the years, we were asked to come and testify as a non-hostile witness on renewable energy and covered lagoons and the things that we had done. And we were on both lists. We were on Smithfield's witness list, and we were on the plaintiff's witness list. The plaintiffs called us and asked us to testify. Smithfield didn't. So I ended up testifying in all five trials, and my testimony was strictly, does your hog farm have odor? I said, yes. Your neighbors say anything about your odor? I says, yes. And do you think that there is a better way than the spray field system? And I says, yes. That's basically all of my testimony that I did. And we did get a little bit into the fact that the system I had was not profitable, and why would anybody do it? You know, so they had that in their corner. But you got to do research and development to get there. I mean, anybody, you know, knows that. You got to start somewhere. But, you know, now it's in the Court of Appeals. And had it not been for COVID, we would have already had a decision. But January the 31st, the Fourth Circuit up in Richmond, Virginia, heard the oral arguments. And normally within 6 months, they would have made a decision. But due to COVID, that's not happened yet. So just maybe tomorrow, next day, the decision will come down as to whether or not to certify all five jury verdicts, which were, guilty as charged as a nuisance, or they can nullify all of them and we'll be back to square one after $50 or $60 million spent in court. But that is our system. All of the five juries has come down to three judges, and they will make the decision. The head judge and the panel shocked everybody when we were at the oral arguments. If you just read what he said that day, he was totally on the plaintiff's side. But you never know. You can't ever second guess the judicial system, because there's three judges. So all three have to come to a decision on whether to certify them or nullify them. And it will have, if they do certify the lawsuits, it's going to amount close to $100 million in damages paid back to the plaintiffs. It was close to $580 million. But due to laws and caps, it was reduced back down to, I believe it's 97 or 98 million. And that would go to 518 plaintiffs that brought the lawsuit.
In the case that these nuisance suits do go through, and, you know, I've spoken to many people now that are either family farms or part of a farming community that's being affected by being in close proximity to a CAFO. Obviously for them, it's good that they're winning, but for, let's say that this case was brought against you and your farm, and the plaintiffs won, what would happen to you?
It's my responsibility, to do the right thing. And if I go to court and they prove to me that Tom Butler is not doing a good job and he is a nuisance to his community, I should voluntarily shut down. You just don't go against the grain because you say that you feed the world. Well, my saying is you can feed the world and do it right, and not worry. In a capitalistic society, we can't do that. We got to make that money. But there's two or three different ways to skin a cat, they say, and you just have to look for those options instead of just profit. I heard one analogy by a speaker. It should be people, profit, and the planet. If you'd follow that idea and then make a rational decision, all this would go away.
But let's say it's not Tom Butler that has the suit against them. What would the average CAFO farmer do? Would they continue to operate, or are there other consequences that they would face as a contract grower?
Yeah, I think they would take it as an insult to them and their right to farm. And there would be a lot of issues. And so far, the integrators would back them. If you decided to fight, I've heard them say, we got unlimited resources and we will fight. if somebody comes in and tries to shut us down. So, but it would be a squabble, a really big squabble.
And what is what's your relationship like with your community now?
Good. We actually had a chance to EPA wanted to actually come to a farm, look at and smell, see what people were talking about when they sent all the complaints to Washington. So we had a team of about 15 that came and looked at our farm. And while they didn't get the full brunt of, you know, a regular farm, that they got a good idea of what the hog farm was like. And then we had a meeting with 20 of our neighbors. I invited them to the meeting and they actually came. And the mistake I made was that I told them all to tell the truth. I said, now these people really know the truth. And I got my ears burned off that night, but I appreciated that. I appreciated the people being truthful, and they did talk about odors. They talked about children with asthma. They talked about flies. They talked about how it affected if we were spraying on a day and their 16-year-old daughter had her first date and this guy comes and picks her up and he smells his hog poop. You know, he says, what is that? You know, how could you stand that? Stuff like that is actually what we ran into.
That's pretty funny, actually.
I'm glad you enjoyed that. But yeah, we actually had that as an example, you know.
That's a good one.
But yeah, birthday parties, you know, we had one neighbor with a brand new pool, you know, and if the wind was blowing, you know, it didn't smell like chlorine, it smelled like hog poop, you know. So he asked me, the owner of that home asked me if I could turn the fans the other way.
Oh, man. I have one more question for you before I let you go today. And that is, okay, how has working on this farm for so many years, several decades now, affected your health and your family's health?
Well, see, this is what I always tell people. For several years, I was in the barns every day, or 3 or 4 days a week. My brother and I worked together. Sometimes I would do chores away from the farm, and he would do chores at the farm. And I grew up with having asthma. I had asthma at a very young age. And with all of that, I'm 80, 79 years old, almost 80, and I don't know of any side effects other than the one that Duke University has proven in several research projects, that people living near hog farms tend to be anemic, and I'm anemic, and I can't control that. So if the hog farm caused that, so be it. There's no way for me to prove that it did or didn't. But other than that, I've not suffered any ill effects. And see, this is what's so tough on people that do have side effects from it, to prove that they do. And when a grower doesn't, and you probably don't hear about growers that have problems, you know, if they really have problems from being the hog farm, you just don't hear about it. It's not mentioned.
It's part of the reason why I asked, because I was curious. I mean, I hear so much from community members saying that they've increased asthma or other issues. The anemia part is really interesting, which I want to look into more. I hadn't heard that yet.
Duke University, they've done, I can't remember the doctor's name that did it, but you can readily look it up.
Yeah, I definitely will. That's really curious, actually. And obviously, I'm very happy that you don't have any horrible health problems stemming from working on a CAFO. Obviously, it's not something I wish on anybody. Do you have any final comments before we log off today?
I appreciate what you're doing, and I appreciate being a part of it. And again, I will say I love my industry. I want us to be successful in North Carolina and stay here because I don't want the farm to close down. And we're getting close to that point if we don't adopt a new technology.
Thank you so much for being here today, Tom, and for being willing to speak openly and honestly about how you run your farm. You're truly a great wealth of information, and the team wishes you all the best going forward. Thank you.